Why a Blip is Not a Blip, from an economist with an aviation resume. I'm Paul Plagg, and this is Aero News. Welcome in to this Aero News special feature, and thanks for downloading us today. My guest is Dr. Michael Trethewey, who was recommended to us by a number of people in the user fee debate that's going on now between the FAA, the Congress, and what we call the alphabet groups, including the National Business Aviation Association and the Aircraft Owners and Pilots Association. On July 5th, on our special feature, we talked to Robert Poole, who is the Director for Transportation Studies of the Reason Foundation, and he expressed some views. Specifically, he feels that we should want user fees as individual pilots because it would result in a better system, and for many of us, we would actually pay less. We're here to talk now, though, about the econometrics, as they're called, that the FAA is applying to come up with these numbers of who uses how much of the system and who is paying how much into it. Dr. Trethewey, first, thanks for joining us today. You have, I have to say, a resume that's remarkable. Not only have you studied econometrics a great deal, but you have a tremendous aviation and airport management background.
That's right. I actually have a PhD in economics from the University of Wisconsin, then taught in the Center for Transport Studies at the University of British Columbia for 14 years. But then following that, I joined the Vancouver International Airport Authority, which is the first of the commercialized or privatized airports in Canada, and then went on to Australia, where I was with the Bureau of Transport Economics while they were commercializing and privatizing their airports and commercializing Air Nav. Now I've got a consulting firm that is called InterVistas Consulting.
Just so we know where you're coming from in this, is your consulting firm consulting any of the groups that I mentioned in opening this segment, or are you completely independent at this point?
No, we've been retained by the National Business Aviation Association specifically to assist them in understanding cost allocation methodologies. And in the process of that engagement, the new FAA study came out, and so we've had a detailed look at that as well.
Why is it so hard for people to agree on how much each segment of aviation is using of the air traffic control system?
But it's difficult because there's so many different users, and different users impose different costs on the system. If you have an automobile production plant, for example, and perhaps you produce a number of different models in there, you know, you produce some trucks, and you produce some very small cars. How you allocate the cost among the different units is actually not a simple task. There's a lot of things. You know, who did you build the factory for? Is part of the production just ancillary to it or not?
Under any model that I've heard discussed, especially from the FAA side, in any evaluation I have seen, general aviation still comes out with less revenue generated going into the FAA than it is a consumer of services coming out. Is that a fair statement?
I think it is a fair statement for what the FAA has produced. Now, I don't think FAA's methodology is right. But I also think that their own numbers are being bandied about incorrectly. A commonly cited number is that general aviation contributes 3% and it incurs or is allocated 16% of the cost. In fact, the FAA's own data shows that how the FAA defines general aviation, there's a lot of different definitions, but the way they define it, general aviation contributes 8.5% of the revenues. The cost allocation number that they came up with is 16.5%, although even that's not an apples-to-apples comparison. The challenge is that how did they get the 16.5%? And they have what appears to be a complicated methodology, but when you get down into the math, it ends up being real simple. And that's a blip is a blip and a mile is a mile. So any ETMS aircraft that's in the system is going to be assumed to drive the same cost as any other aircraft. So a 747 that's coming in for an approach in Chicago, for example, is going to be assumed to drive exactly the same cost as a light turboprop aircraft, for example, that might be landing at a tower in Jackson, Mississippi.
The FAA says that it does not intend to charge that light plane flying into Jackson only if the light aircraft use the 30 major hubs. The main argument I've heard against that is that, yeah, for now, Are you concerned with the pure math of it, or the politics down the road that may change the funding structure?
Well, I'm an economist. I'm concerned with the math. The politics I leave to other folks.
Okay.
The math that they have, though, is wrong. I mean, one of the things I found most interesting is the last time the FAA looked at this, which was 1997, in the appendix of their own study, they did econometric analysis that showed that landings of different types of aircraft are driving different FAA costs. That's exactly what the Australians and Canadians found, by the way, in their own cost allocation studies. And this time around, the FAA has been very candid. They said that while we used economic principles in the past to do our cost allocation, they did this in 97 and several times earlier, we've abandoned economic principles and now we're going with a very simplistic cost accounting approach. And that cost accounting approach fundamentally treats a blip as a blip, except for piston aircraft. Piston aircraft are hived off and treated a little different, but they're a pretty insignificant share of all of this.
Okay, I guess as an economist, tell me why a blip is not a blip.
Well, as an economist, I guess there's a couple of ways you can approach this. One is, statistically, does a blip as a blip show up? And the answer is, it doesn't. As I indicated, the FAA's own statistical analysis in 97, and that's been more recent in Canada and Australia, simply finds that that's not the case. On an intuitive basis, though, you know, kind of going out and talking to the industry, you know, the Air Traffic Controllers Association itself has said a blip is not a blip. They testified to that, I can't remember if it was April or May, in front of the House. Now, when I talk with controllers, and we have a number of ex-controllers actually in our organization, they say that, you know, look, if you're flying from one airport to another, if the traffic is relatively light, you do a straight-in approach. On the other hand, if you're flying into Detroit when Northwest has got a big peak operation going, you might be vectored out for 20, 40 miles into a big U as everybody gets lined up. And controlling that is complicated. You're continually giving instructions to each aircraft to descend a little bit, adjust their speed, and so forth. That requires resources. There's actually more flying involved when you're going into a hub airport because of the lineup. To do the approach, and the aircraft are close enough that, you know, controllers have to pay a lot of attention to this. So I just think that both on statistical and intuitive grounds, a blip being a blip is not supported.
Then we come down to the idea that we can't allocate costs to business turboprops or light jets on the same basis we do Uncle Fred's Cessna 152. So how do you make sure that business aircraft that do impose some loads, that often do fly IFR and at least use the ATC system, are charged fairly? Or do you think they are being now?
If I look at the data from 97, it appears to me that they're actually very close to being charged the correct amount. The FAA's own study that was done in 97, you can actually look at that and determine what's called incremental cost. What are the extra costs in the system imposed by general aviation? Or another way to look at this is, if general aviation was grounded and it didn't fly at all, would there be any savings in FAA costs? If so, how much? And the analysis in the FAA's own study is that about 8% of FAA costs would be saved if general aviation ceased to exist in the medium to long term. And that roughly is what they were paying in 97, and it appears to be what they were paying in 2005 as well. And by the way, general aviation actually has not grown by very much at all. If we go back, for example, to 1980, the number of movements of general aviation has actually been negative, whereas these are towered airports, whereas the commercial air transport users actually increased by 80% the number of movements at towered airports.
Okay, if a blip is not a blip, take the example of a regional jet versus an Airbus A380. They may be flying in similar environments. The regional jet may be flying into one of the 30 large hubs. Is there any difference then between one aircraft carrying 550 people and one aircraft that's carrying 50 people in terms of its expense or impact on the air traffic control system?
I don't think that the evidence supports the notion that the number of passengers in the aircraft makes a difference to the air traffic control costs. There may, however, be a difference between an A380 in a regional jet. The A380 in particular, it appears, is going to need much larger separations than a regional jet does, and I suspect that that's going to drive different air traffic and control costs.
We're talking with Dr. Michael Trethewey, who is Vice President and Chief Economist for Intavistas Consulting Incorporated. We're talking about the econometrics of trying to figure out who should pay what for the air traffic control system. I'm Paul Platt. You're listening to a special feature from Aero News.
At Cirrus Design, we don't ignore the fundamentals of aviation design. We just give them an ingenious new interpretation. The Cirrus SR22 GTS, Cirrus's premium luxury ride that has come to define Cirrus aircraft as one of the world's elite. Every dream option, from supple leather seats to an exhilarating 310 horsepower performance and speed, comes standard, giving new meaning to the phrase fully loaded. When flying the SR22 GTS, getting there is truly more than half the fun. To learn more, call 888-750-9927 or check us out on the web at cirrusdesign.com.
Finally, aviation headsets have evolved. Clarity Aloft is the next generation of headset design. Clarity Aloft headsets employ patented Comply Canal tips, composed of soft viscoelastic foam, the same foam tips used in advanced hearing aids. More than simple earplugs, these foam tips provide full-spectrum noise reduction and outstanding attenuation. This advanced technology is lab-tested, proving that viscoelastic passive noise reduction is superior to active noise reduction. For more information, call 612-747-3197 or check out the innovative Clarity Aloft headset on the web at clarityaloft.com.
Welcome back to this Aero News special feature. I'm Paul Plack, talking today with Dr. Michael Trethewey, who is Vice President and Chief Economist of Intervistas Consulting Incorporated. He has a very distinguished academic background and also a lot of work in the aviation sector in terms of trying to help airports market themselves and also figure out what things really cost in the aviation world. So he's a great person to talk to about this. Dr. Trethewey, let me ask you now to put yourself in the position of being assigned. Say you were given an assignment to just lay out the block diagram of how the system should run. You seem to be on the same page with Bob Poole of the Reason Foundation in at least one aspect, and that is that there could be some advantages to privatization. Tell us, first of all, where you fall in that spectrum.
Well, I've actually looked at the privatization issue quite extensively. I actually was involved in an airport that was converted from government operation to a not-for-profit commercialized operation. Pure privatization, where it's actually the private sector operating an airport with an appropriate regulatory regime with appeals of that, can actually work quite well. Where I differ significantly from Mr. Poole is that I really find the not-for-profit governance structure to be problematic, and it actually ends up, paradoxically, with higher fees than a pure private sector operation would have.
How does that happen? I know one of the things that that Bob Poole talked about was the U.S. Postal Service, which I don't know if it has been as successful as people have hoped it had hoped it would be in controlling costs and in being a freestanding body. I know that it does not achieve some of the management incentives and internal efficiencies of a private enterprise.
Look, one of the problems with a not-for-profit model is it does not have access to equity capital. It can only go to debt. And the financial sector does not like to give 100% debt financing to any organization.
Right.
So when I was at the Vancouver airport and it had just been converted to a not-for-profit organization, the first thing that had to be done is we had to generate equity somehow or retained earnings. And the only way to do that was to raise your fees above your cost to generate a surplus. Now, when I look at NAV Canada, for example, which Mr. Poole thinks is the next best thing to sliced bread, NAV Canada has had to charge fees that are in excess of its costs in order to generate the equity that it needs. In fact, it's got this rate stabilization fund, and what that fund is they charge users more than cost in order to build up a surplus in the organization. Doesn't matter to me whether that's called a surplus or whether that's called profit. It's building retained earnings in the organization. not-for-profits, economists study them and actually find that they're not always motivated to be efficient. Sometimes they are, sometimes they're not, but it often depends a lot on the personalities that are that are on the board.
What specifically would you change about NAV Canada?
I think that NAV Canada needs access to equity capital. So that's one possibility. Do you go like has been done to some extent in the United Kingdom with some parts of their Tracon services? Is do we go to a pure private sector operation that has access to equity? It certainly has worked very well in those countries like the United Kingdom and Australia that have fully privatized their airports. The key, of course, here is if you go to private sector, you must have a regulatory regime that comes with it, a price regulatory regime. And that's one of the problems that often come with the not-for-profit governance model. NAV Canada has no regulator. You cannot appeal a NAV Canada fee, except you can appeal to the Canada Transportation Agency if you feel that NAV Canada didn't follow the right process, but you cannot appeal the actual fee that comes out. They have an unconstrained ability to charge whatever price that they want.
Now, the assumption when you move to a pure private sector model is that there will be competition that will be the incentive to keep a lid on prices. Why would people not simply choose different airports or different routing if there was a difference in those prices? Is the problem that we'd have to have a monopoly?
Well, with air traffic control, there appear to be pretty substantial economies of scale, so we kind of would call that a natural monopoly. And I'm not aware of any place where you have a choice, for example, between air traffic controllers. In the United Kingdom, an airport can choose which company will operate its tower, for example, so I suppose there's some indirect competition for that, but they've been careful to put a regulatory regime on top of all of that.
Dr. Trethewey, the FAA seems to be on a path where it wants to completely cover its costs by allocating them to users of the air traffic control system. Is there anything about this approach that cannot give us the most efficient system we'd want?
Yes, there's a fundamental inconsistency here with good economics and full cost allocation and air traffic control. In economics 101, everybody learns that if you have an industry that's got economies of scale, prices should be set to what economists call marginal cost or incremental cost, and doing that is going to leave a deficit for the operator. And in industries that have economies of scale that are of strategic importance to the economy, it's appropriate then for the government to come in and provide support to the general treasury. And the FAA's approach is one that says, yes, we have economies of scale in this industry. We're going to allocate all of our costs to users, and we're not going to have any contribution from the federal treasury. I don't see any evidence that Congress has asked them for that, Congress seems continually willing to provide a contribution to the fixed and overhead and research costs of FAA. They're a great benefit. And this is consistent with economic principles. Prices should be set to the incremental cost of each user type in the system, and the General Treasury should come in with a contribution, which in the FAA's case has ranged from somewhere in kind of the 15 to 20% range to the 50% range over the years.
There seems to be a historical precedent for Congress stepping up. In fact, if I understand correctly, Congress has always given the FAA as much or more than it asked for.
I think you can count on Congress. This sector is so important to the nation for emergency response, for connectivity of our economy and so on. They have always been there with funding. It's the right economic thing to do. If you don't do this, and this is one of the problems in Canada, is that the air traffic control system starts to price out important traffic. In Canada, a consequence of the not-for-profit governance model with full cost allocation is that a lot of air cargo services that would have been built through Canada aren't there because the cost of landing in Canada is so expensive for a cargo flight that you might as well just overfly Canada and go on to Asia or Europe. At my airport at Vancouver, we definitely have lost and foregone direct or air cargo service that would have come to Vancouver, but for the charges that NAV Canada has put in place because they're using full cost allocation.
So if I understand correctly, recreational pilots or pilots of small aircraft are on some sort of annual membership system, but if you get into the bigger planes, it's still the cash register in the sky, unquote?
Yes, NAV Canada has simplified the fee structure for some of the smallest aircraft, which is good, but nevertheless, their fee collection system is very expensive. They won't even reveal the cost of this because I understand that it's so controversial that they won't provide any information. But in the U.S. context, let's say that the collection costs are only 0.1% from a user fee system. Well, that's $100 million a year. If you need an additional $300 million for modernization per year, and you impose user fees, well, not imposing user fees kind of gets you a third of the way right there.
Well, you know what? I think this is going to remain a complicated debate. My goal the past couple of weeks have been to try to find a couple of people who could kind of pry under the rock and get past the almost political election campaign type hype that has characterized, I think, both sides of the debate. I found it interesting that that Bob Poole seemed to be on a whole third side of the debate in most of what he said, and that was, this is too important to let the FAA mess with it.
Well, I think we would share a common view there that I don't think FAA doing this cost allocation, because remember, in the congressional proposal, fees must be based on the cost allocation study. There's too many places for errors in that, and that has the potential to really displace needlessly a lot of traffic in the United States.
Dr. Michael Trethewey is Vice President and Chief Economist of InterVistas Consulting Incorporated. Is there any place where our listeners could go to get more information or to follow white papers or other reports as they're coming out?
Well, our website is www.intervistas.com, and we have a number of articles and publications there.
Dr. Trethewey, thanks very much for joining us and helping shed some light on this debate.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You've been listening to a special feature from Aero News. On the web, you can find us at www.aero-news.net. I'm Paul Plack. Thanks for listening. Have a clear and unlimited day.